All right, welcome back to the podcast. I'm excited to have Patrick Miller as my guest today. Patrick has had an extensive career in critical infrastructure cybersecurity that includes a role in the establishment of the NERC-SIP standards 2 decades ago now. Currently, Patrick is president and CEO of Ampere Industrial Security and president emeritus of EnergySec. So I imagine we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion with Patrick today, but the impetus for us getting together is a blog he wrote recently that unfortunately is very timely now given some of the geopolitical tensions around the world. The blog, which I will link to in the show notes, stresses the need for electric utilities especially, but I guess it applies to all critical infrastructure, to start talking about communication and response and information sharing in the light of kinetic conflict in the world. And we'll also talk about the need to develop some playbooks for resilience and response. So before we get into that discussion, just a couple of some of the usual reminders. One is to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. You don't want to miss conversations like today, and it really helps out to subscribe and spread the word about these episodes as the interest and the need for information around industrial cybersecurity ramps up. Also, just want to note that Clarity's research team, Team 82, has recently launched a Slack channel. I'll also include a link to that in the show notes that you can use to join the channel if you choose. You'll be able to connect with our researchers about any of the reports they've written, some of the disclosures they've been involved in, and any other relevant topics. So now that that's out of the way, let's bring in Patrick and get started. Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for joining. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I think this will be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, unfortunately, it's kind of timely given what's going on and what isn't going on in the world today. But obviously some heavy issues and, you know, especially in light of the Russia-Ukraine tension that's going on. What types of discussions are happening, should be happening within electric companies and other critical infrastructure right now? With these two countries on the brink, I mean, especially we're seeing some cyber attacks allegedly related to this stuff. And it always has this tendency to spill over these conflicts into many domains. So what do you imagine some of the discussions that are happening right now?
Well, I know, of course, you know, my near and dear home is the electric sector, but it's pretty similar across the board for all sectors. At least for ours, we have an ISAC, and of course, other sectors have their own ISAC.
Right.
The ISACs typically issue things that are like all points bulletins or, you know, process bulletins that contain whatever they've got in terms of IOCs or known actions. And that certainly happened in the electric sector as well. So they've got theirs, and they're busy having conversations internally about what they can do. What we've seen in this, I guess, it's not like any sector is different, right? The gas sector, the water sector, the chemical sector. If the adversary wants to get into those networks, you know, they didn't start, you know, today. They've been working on this probably for some time, understanding what the landscape looks like, what kinds of technologies are used, human practices and behaviors from everything from operators to, you know, standard, you know, I guess average corporate enterprise staff, you know, figure out what paths they can take. So it's not like, you know, any kind of immediate knee-jerk reaction you take right now is going to stop this from happening.
Right.
But there's some good practices that have come out. And I think the standard stuff, you know, multi-factor authentication, all that kind of, you know, I guess, blocking and tackling and standard hygiene things, those are a lot of the recommendations. And it's what shocks me is that that's not already done for some organizations, first of all. But some of the more interesting ones, and I've been saying this for a long time, and it's finally getting actually written down as, you know, CISA produced their document recently, kind of giving everybody some tips. And in there was one of the key ones that's different. And it's everything else is kind of standard, what we see all the time. But the new one is disconnecting your operational networks from other networks. And, you know, my good friend Mark Bristow at CISA coined the term turtle mode. We used to call it, you know, intelligent islanding and shear away networks and all these other crafty terms, but his is probably, you know, really gets that visceral understanding. You just lock the shell down and wait until the danger passes and then open back up and continue business. I think that recommendation, though we've been talking about it for a long time, this is the first time I've actually had real conversations with my utility clients about what would you do? Could you actually do this? And if this, you know, conflict does get, you know, prolonged or, you know, starts to clearly spill over into any supporting, you know, ally country, is probably going to see some attacks for pressure and confusion and all those standard things that come with warfare, kinetic right. warfare. You know, once that spills over into your space, could you really do this? And how long could you do it for? And that's the real, I guess, the burning issue for a lot of these organizations. They have various forms of logging and monitoring and, you know, upping the authentication and reviewing what they're seeing and that kind of thing. And the ability in some cases now to put in IOCs and get value out of that. So that stuff has been maturing and it's getting better. And in some cases it's refined, but this one's new. This one's a challenge.
Is that one practical?
Yeah.
It sounds really challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. Right now it's not practical. No. I mean, right now it's like, you know, dropping a boulder into a bucket of water. It's going to smash. It's infeasible in a lot of ways because we've said for so long that, you know, we don't need to do this or we can operate manually or we've had lots of other, in some cases, legitimate and in some cases, yeah, absolutely, you know, wrong excuses. But it's a problem that needs to be solved because we do need to be able to island off these environments and let them run. We saw with the Colonial Pipeline attack, and now it's the poster child and, you know, everyone on their bingo card can X this one off. But, you know, they shut down their OT environment because of impact on the IT side. It's just the dependencies there were so high. So, this is, you know, common, I'll say, across almost all industries that I've seen, that there really isn't this, you know, solid, detailed understanding of knowing what's going on in terms of the impact to OT if you end up having to sever those connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like you said, Colonial's kind of the poster child for this. And, you know, that was a ransomware attack and it kind of gets conflated as an OT attack. And it's not really, it's not what happened. And it's not.
No, yeah.
And I don't know that we're getting full value out of all those lessons from that attack, especially.
Yeah, I'd like to see more. I mean, and that one did prompt the discussion. I think it's actually what spawned Mark the Coin Turtle Mode in a lot of the mm-hmm. discussions that came after that. But yeah, this is, I think, the other stuff, you know, yeah, they can get there. It's going to be a little painful. Some of these things, you know, they might need to you know, add some new tech or, you know, reconfigure some things and lock down and get, you know, more capability, more IOCs, more visibility. But this one is going to be very difficult.
Right. Take me through some of the drivers for the blog that you wrote, maybe beyond kind of the geopolitics. I mean, you must be seeing some gaps around communication in terms of response and information sharing within the sector. Is that fair? Yeah. I mean, what are you seeing there?
Yeah, I think right now what we've got is this I'm being polite by calling it a haphazard approach to kind of information sharing. And, you know, if I were being really blunt and straightforward, it's kind of like a clown car approach, to be honest, where in every sector has somebody to report to and they've got other people to report to. Some of them are required reporting. Some of them are just, you know, probably should. And if you don't, you're going to get publicly shamed and nagged. That's just from the notification perspective, much less allowing them to participate or have visibility and transparency into your response, mm-hmm. right? I mean, again, going back to Colonial is one of our better examples. They were publicly chastised for not working well with the federal space when this happened. And, you know, they dragged their CEO in front of Congress and hit him about the head, neck, and shoulders with a bunch of difficult questions. And no CEO wants to do that. They may or may not be prepared for that, but none of them want that. There are other ways to avoid that. Going forward, I'm sure some CEOs are now thinking of options, right? But I use in this blog I did the electric sector is the perfect example. It's regulated, right? It has NERC-SIP and the regulations around what they have to do in terms of reporting. If you have a true, you know, what's called a reportable cybersecurity incident, which is basically a cybersecurity incident that impacts your operations, your electric power delivery for the bulk system. The bulk electric system. If you have some impact there, you're required to report this to NERC within an hour, to the EISAC within an hour, which is part of NERC. Okay, where in this when do you determine, you know, the actual situation? How do you know? Is it speculated? And then, you know, of course, that would be a compliance violation in addition to the fact that once you notify NERC, then there's this timeline that starts with when you have to update them. And there's certain information components that have to be in the update. At the same time, you have to report to the Department of Energy on what's known as an OE-417 form for a security-related outage of mm-hmm. your environment. CISA has to get notified as well per the regulation. So that right there, out of the gate, if something did hit your operational network and cause an operational outage, you've got three parties that you have to report to right away, like right away. And they're not the same form. They're different details that go to different agencies. So, you know, you've got somebody has to get the information to the people that have to fill out the form. So there's this internal communication cycle that goes on that really starts with, of course, the incident responders trying to figure out what's going on. How bad is it? When does the clock start? Are we past an hour yet? Are we past the 15-minute window yet? All of these things that come into this internal kind of triage state.
Right.
That's just getting the initial, like, you know, shot across the bow, letting them know something's happening. And then after that, especially if it's something that looks like, I mean, if it were an average sunny day, and, you know, there was no, you know, political strife or no geopolitical tension going on, there would likely be no, you know, or there'd be less immediate nation state concern. Given the situation we have now, you're likely to have, you know, various intelligence agencies, you know, pick a three-letter agency that might have skin in the game, like all of them, in addition to, you know, the EISAC, CISA, and the DOE.
Right.
Now, once this notification goes out, and let's say you get requests from one or all of them, should you respond? Well, in some of the cases, you're required to by law to respond. In other cases, you're not. It's probably a good idea. But now you've got this, you know, barrage of communications that you're going to have to maintain to all of these different parties asking likely different things with different motives. So that was what I wanted the utilities to at least think about, you know, before this happens. So yeah. In the event it does happen, you've got at least a plan. And it's mm-hmm. probably going to not unfold like you want, but at least it'll unfold, you know, closer to your plan if you have a plan. It's just going to go sideways if you have no plan.
Right. And do you have a sense for the preparedness of utilities in this regard? I mean, you know, it seems like forever we've been talking about tabletop exercises and, yeah. you know, bringing in PR and legal and HR and everybody under the sun in terms of response activities, you know, how what do you gauge the level of preparedness right now?
Well, I think at least for the electric utilities and for some of the others as well, response is kind of in their bloodstream. It's in their mm-hmm. DNA. So, you know, standing up a response center, like an incident command center and, you know, various forms of communication. Think of like if you have a hurricane or an earthquake or a wildfire yeah. or something like that, you know how to stand up an incident command center. You know how to set up the communication paths to the governor or the National Guard or all these kinds of other areas. So a lot of that's already in their DNA. What isn't in their DNA is all of the additional overhead that comes from the other stuff, like three-letter agencies asking hard questions with difficult to obtain answers. You know, the regulatory timelines that you have to meet or you will get penalized. Those kind of situations. So that mm-hmm. that's a bit different. Now, NERC, you know, to give them a little credit, they every other year they do what's called GridX, and they hold a massive kind of sector-wide incident response exercise. And it's huge. It's detailed. It's very well produced. It covers, God, the scenarios run from, you know, vandalism all the way up to and including stuff like alien abductions. I mean, it really runs the entire gamut. It's insane how you know, it gets active shooter, you name it. It's got everything.
Yeah.
So it gives you a chance to kind of run through the buffet, the like the Vegas buffet of incident response exercises. But, you know, like anything that is that big, a lot of the utilities, you know, they participate to varying degrees. And I mean, all honestly, a lot of them just do paper exercises and they kind of follow along if they follow along with GridX. But for the what's called the low impact space or the smaller utilities, they're only required to do it basically once every 3 years. The bigger yeah. utilities have to do it once a year. And they have some varying degrees in terms of what they have to do, you know, for the cycles. But they could literally just walk through their plan occasionally, and that would work. Yeah. It's not practicing like it's game day. It's not actually calling these agencies and letting them know you're going through an incident response drill. You know, creating that that initial pathway there, running it through your legal team, getting your corporate crisis communications involved, standing up. Okay, who's going to respond to the three-letter agencies? Who's going to respond to the governor? Who's going to respond to NERC and CISA and DOE? Those internal groups. And then what happens if things go exigent, for example, and you know you lose communications completely? How do you maintain some of those things? Because if you're under active attack, and like you're trying to get the lights back on, that part is where it starts to get really muddy. You have to run through this in a scenario of, okay, we're in a, you know, geopolitical high tension situation. We may or may not be actively at war with an adversary. And if that's the case, and we believe that adversary is now attacking a power system on our soil, when you get questions from these agencies up to and including DOD, your job is to get the lights back on, because you've got customers that are out of power. You've got cop shops, fire stations, hospitals, banking and finance, gas can't pump, water can't flow. Mom's oxygen is going to, you know, taper off in 72 hours. You know, all of these things are severe life-threatening crises, you know, realistic issues. But you may have a nation state, a national agency of some kind telling you to operate different than you want to, because right. you may not be able to get the lights back on because some agency is not giving you directives.
Mm-hmm. That's and you're going to have a terrified population chances are too. If the lights goes out during a war, that's something no one's ever experienced because of a cyber attack.
Right. Right. So, you know, there will definitely be panic. And if people think otherwise, again, colonial, they're putting, you know, gasoline in plastic bags, you know, and it wasn't really a situation that was, you know, warfare. It was just ransomware. So, you know, if you take all those other tensions up and take it to that level and run an exercise under those premises and under that scenario, that's what I'm suggesting, is that we actually figure out, what do you do when you've got competing motivations from federal elements and you as a utility to get the lights back on, regardless of size, right? I mean, it doesn't matter if it happens to like some irrigation district in the middle of nowhere, or if it happens in LA or New York or San Antonio or something like that. Mm-hmm. Either way, it's going to be the power went out in America because some foreign adversary took the lights out.
Yeah.
The best example is like Oldsmar. It's a tiny little water district in Florida, and it's been used so many times as an example that the water industry is woefully insecure. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter at the size, right? I'm just saying it will immediately have a ripple effect. And the follow-on for that will be whatever happened there. Now every other utility is going to be in lockdown mode and answering similar questions. What are you seeing? So it's not just going to be that one utility that has to respond like this. Their neighbors and every other utility in the country is going to have similar right. conversations, just at a right. different level of depth.
And, you know, and just to comment, those images you referenced from the time during the colonial attack with the people shoving gasoline in plastic bags, it was just amazing images, but regardless, we got through that. Russia's action against the Ukrainian power system in the past, I mean, mm-hmm. I would imagine that would have been a massive wake-up call to folks within the industry. What do you think was there an adequate response since then, or are we just going to be reactive forever until it hits us, until it affects me, I'm not going to do anything about it?
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely, you know, practice. That's how they sure. operate.
Yep.
So it was practice on how to take out a distribution system and part of a transmission system. And they wanted to try how to do it in a way that it would make it, you know, very difficult, if not impossible, to restore the system. Mm-hmm. So they're impacting the utility's ability to respond, knowing how, like I say, response is in their DNA. So if you know how they're going to respond, then you know how to impact their response, you know, options and capabilities. So did our sector in the U.S. take it to heart? Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you. I mean, for years, still to this day, we reference that that attack. It's I teach the SANS ICS 456 for SIP course, and you know, the NERC SIP stuff, and we go through extensively, you know, that level of attack to show the people in the utilities this is what happened and this is how it impacted them, and you can see because it's utility specific knowledge, and so you can see the folks that are in there from the utility and their eyes just, you know, look like frying pans because they're like, wow, oh, they did what? When they really understand the mechanics behind how it happened.
Sure.
So yeah, the industry did take it to heart. And there were a lot of other kind of just discussions that at levels of the organization that wouldn't have happened before. And you finally had something to point at and say, this is not theoretical. This is now a reality. And this is now table stakes, right? Mm-hmm. This power systems are now table stakes. So we know their capabilities, at least in this situation. And, you know, honestly, you know, the Ukraine wasn't that digitized. So you know, the higher the digitized an organization is, the more digital their system is, then there's a, you know, more potential for some of these things, depending upon lots of factors, of course. But yeah. And then, you know, of course, Ukraine had the capability, since they weren't so digital, to go to manual in a lot of cases. We don't have much of that. We get some of that in the US, but it would be very challenging to do it for a prolonged period of time.
Right.
Especially if it was, you know, more than one region was hit. Because we have this very strong thing called mutual assistance in the power space where anything happens, another utility just show up with trucks and people and resources. We even have it in the cyberspace. We have cyber mutual assistance, particularly in the municipals. So if there's a cyber incident, we can actually borrow other cyber people and they can come help. So the industry is really good at that part. And I, you know, but you know, when you ask what really changed is, I think executives got it. They're like, okay, we can't keep saying this. This hasn't happened. There's been no public knowledge. They basically had to say, okay, all right, we probably need to do something. And it's more than just, you know, NERC SIP.
Right.
And that's, I think, a big challenge is a lot of organizations think if I'm SIP compliant, then I am secure. Honestly, that's the lowest bar of the rung of the ladder. That is, you must be this tall to ride the utility ride. If you're going to be a utility in the U.S., then this is the minimum you have to do. It's not like you're now suddenly terrorist proof. It's a completely different discussion. Right. So that it elevated the conversation beyond that kind of floor level understanding of NERC SIP, thinking we probably should do some other things, some more stuff.
You know, I can remember in another life, I was a journalist, and I remember writing about, you know, hacks of critical infrastructure, and a lot of them were just brushed off as, well, maybe not brushed off, but they were kind of labeled as capabilities demonstrations and adversaries mapping and learning networks and trying to steal, you know, process data, et cetera. And almost kind of brushing off these intrusions because they weren't that destructive. And to me, it's just as scary as if they were, that these guys are on our networks. And I'm sure that we may be doing the same, but I'm sure you've heard some of these anecdotally as well.
Yeah.
Is that the wrong response to just kind of, you know, we're doing it too kind of thing?
Yeah, it's the wrong response.
Yeah.
Just because we may be doing it doesn't mean that it's like in some way okay for the others to do it to us. And it should just one of those things. Yeah. I mean, think of it in a kinetic situation. The first thing that you want to take out is their electricity and their comms and their transportation. So that they can't communicate their troops, they can't move their troops, and they've got no power wherever they go. That severely limits the capabilities. The same thing from, you know, cyber warfare. It's these are high value targets. So having any adversary of any nature and any motivation in your high value, high value targets, why wouldn't that alarm you?
Right. Yeah, it's scary. And
and
it's just, I mean, I guess the only thing keeping it from from destructive attacks happening more often is the fear or the chance of proportional retaliation.
I mean, there's lots of talk of, you know, packets turning into some sort of kinetic response on the other end. And I think that's a legit, you know, situation. It could escalate to that, you know. NATO has said it. Most nation states have overtly stated this kind of thing. You know, hey, take out our infrastructure and we will likely, you know, roll tanks or fly planes in your direction.
Right.
So, yeah. But you know, to your point, all of these things, you know, I think it's the death by a thousand cuts or the, you know, the anecdote of the frog in the boiling water. We've been kind of desensitized in a lot of ways to these things. And just because it wasn't some shock and awe level attack, we think that these are small things, right? These are, when you aggregate all of these small things, it fills out a very unsettling picture.
Yeah. Do you think that a lot of this is due to the fact that we don't necessarily have either international law or rules of the road that are clearly spelled out where, you know, in terms of conflict, you know, utilities are out of scope for cyber, stuff like this just isn't fair game. I mean, I guess it's a bigger, much bigger discussion, but it always seems that that part of it is kind of ignored as well.
And we're working on cyber norms. There are there's some that are written, some that are unwritten. You know, they're out there, right? But when you're talking about some of these nation states, they don't care about those. Mm-hmm. In fact, they'll hide behind those as though we're following the norms when they're not. So often that can be, you know, used as, you know, a smokescreen or imagine a line, you know, in reality. Right. It's, I think those are very challenging to enforce, you know, other than some of the things we do with like legal action and sanctions. And there's this wide array of levers we can pull when people violate the norms in normal situations. An abnormal situation is kinetic conflict between multiple nations at a time. that kind of waves any norm following, you know, card.
Right. Right. Can we do some myth busting since you're obviously very close to the electric utility industry? How much of a myth is it to say that the grid can be attacked or taken down? I mean, it's just this cliche line from pundits, from mainstream media, when they start talking about cyber, and it kind of drives me nuts because I would imagine it's extraordinarily difficult to do anything like that at scale. I mean, there isn't just one grid, for example. I mean, are we talking about hitting major providers instead, or you know, what's your take on that?
Yeah, it's BS. I mean, I can't put it any more straightforward without just really putting the profanity out there in front of everybody. It's BS. It's really there's not just one grid. At least in North America, there are four, technically five grids, because you have some grids in Canada. You've got, you know, at least the three components in the U.S. You've got Mexico. The North American grid is completely interconnected in various different ways. And it's separated by what are known as interconnects. And these are these massive physical devices called phase shifters and other equipment that literally stop a cascading outage physically, not digitally. It physically moves the rocker and rolls this barrel-shaped thing to separate the power line so that the cascade can't come across it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you couldn't take out all of the North American grids at once. It's just not possible by design. And it was built that way on purpose, not because of adversaries in the cyberspace, but things like, you know, hurricanes, flood, wildfire, earthquakes, squirrels with backhoes, you know? So that is just the first part of the premise of the discussion. And the second part is we didn't build this grid all at once. We built it over time through merger and accretion, different companies, different ages, different technologies. So the absolute mind-boggling array of differential in the technologies, not just from technology platforms, but age, you know, digital versus electromechanical or analog. Sure. All of that mix and that complexity out there makes it, you know, astronomically difficult. I can't say impossible just because it's, you know, the realm of possibility. But there is basically, it would be so astronomically unlikely that you could do anything to all of those different technologies at the same time or in such a way as to cause a cascading outage across all of the different grids, that it would just be impossible.
I mean, right.
It's effectively impossible. Right. But yes, that's a myth and it needs to be busted because it's just not reality. We built this system a lot better than that.
Glad to hear you say all that out loud.
Yeah.
I want to shift a little bit. I want to get your thoughts on some of the government action that's been happening in the last year or so. A lot of it was prompted by Colonial and JBS, but you know, we've seen executive orders and other bills introduced around mandating reporting and 100-day sprints in the different sectors, including electric. I think electric was the first one, if I'm remembering correctly. What were your thoughts on in terms of some of the outcomes, if there were any tangible ones that came out of this, what kind of deliverables were you hoping to see and what actually happened from it?
Yeah, I think it's all good. It got a lot of attention, which is, you know, honestly, all of this stuff starts with kind of acknowledging you have a problem, right? Mm-hmm. So we got awareness of the situation through Colonial and through JBS, you know, even through Ukraine. We've been using all kinds of examples, if you read the documentation, to kind of go through all the public attacks. And, you know, CISA actually has a really good document that they're maintaining showing here's, you know, real public examples of bad stuff happening on critical infrastructure. And this is good because it gives us something authoritative to point to say it's real. It's happening. This is not a theoretical discussion anymore.
Yeah.
So that is useful. Some of the other products, I like a lot of the stuff coming out of CISA, a lot of informational products that we're getting. It's raising the level of awareness. It's giving us some kind of uniform set of IOCs and other things that at least kind of level the playing field for many. So I think those things are good. What is, I think, frustrating to me is, for example, in the National Security Memorandum, the president asked for a unified way to measure the security posture. I'm paraphrasing. Unified way to measure the security posture of these, you know, five critical infrastructures first.
Right.
And it's, you know, obviously electric, gas, chemical, and water, wastewater. If you want to lump them into one sector, mm-hmm. it's technically four. But, you know, so that group kind of gets the first out of the gate. You saw the 100-day sprints, all this stuff for them. At the same time, you're seeing this, I'll call it interesting, quasi-regulatory activity. In the electric sector, we already have NERCSIP, longstanding, you know, regulatory regime through FERC, experienced regulator. Then we see the TSA handling the gas pipeline stuff with these knee-jerk reactions of what looks like, you know, someone kind of threw a dartboard at security controls.
Yeah.
And said, hey, we want this, this, and that. And then the second one came out, we want this, this, and that. And oh, by the way, these things are secret, so none of your consultants can see it. To help you in advance and prepare, they got to come on site and figure it out after the fact. And talk of the water sector getting similar controls to NERCSIP, and now the gas space possibly moving the authority from TSA over to a new kind of NERC-like agency under DOE. So all of this seems to me to be a profound waste of time. Where if the goal is, as stated, to uniformly measure these infrastructures on a common set of base security controls or security posture, we already have a measuring stick for that, and it's NIST 853 and NIST 882. And all these frameworks to me, they're the same thing. It's just different controls mixed up a different way into different buckets and called something else, right? They're all basically all the same. But this is one that's been tried, been true. We have a dedicated government agency to maintain it, to keep it groomed and accommodate whatever, you know, new things come across from a technology standpoint or a uniqueness to a specific sector standpoint. That machine is already built. And it's not just built, but it's been running for a long time and shown its efficiencies. It's been refined multiple times. So if you want a common set of controls to measure all of them, let's stop it with these various different regulations, because honestly, these sectors all think they're unique. It's SCADA. It's right. Whether it's boxes on a belt, water on a pipe, power on the wire, it's flow control. And a lot of it is the exact same manufacturer doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, let's stop it with this silliness about we're unique and we're different. We're not so different that we need to have all of these different approaches and measuring sticks and various degrees of funding and, you know, visibility, information sharing. All this stuff is different for each one of these sectors, which just makes the situation more complicated, more patchwork, more confusing, and frankly, much, much more expensive. So if the cost is the factor and everyone says, oh, we'd be more secure if we could just afford it. All right, let's make it more affordable.
Right.
Let's do it this way. Not only is it a standard measuring stick for all, because now you can get the economy of scale from, you don't have to have specialized consultants for your TSA regs or specialized consultants for your electric stuff or your water stuff. God forbid you're a municipality and you've got all of these things. Now I can just pick one and measure against one common set of controls across all. I can buy common technologies in volume of scale across the board to do these things. And your costs go down dramatically because of this simple change. In addition to that, you got the FARS and TFARS rules that are based on these standards for the government purchasing power behind it. So you can leverage those components as well. If vendors say, well, we don't do that, you can say, yeah, actually you can and you need to, and here's why. So the degree of shift, both, you know, culturally, technology, and the financial components are dramatic. And this is the part that I was hoping we'd get out of this, is some unification or normalization of all of the different patchwork of, frankly, garbage stuff that we've got going on out there to secure our infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Is any of that complicated by the fact that so much critical infrastructure is privately owned? Is that?
Yeah. And that's a legitimate concern, right? But I think there are ways around that. I mean, there definitely are, because we're already doing that with the TSA pipeline safety regs,
right.
The Water Act under the EPA. I mean, we're already doing that. So I think that argument has less and less merit each time we find a new custom fit, you know, regulation or quasi-regulation or norm for any specific sector.
Mm-hmm. All right, so before we wrap up, I had a final set of questions about the NERC-SIP standards, which you were intimately involved with 2 decades ago. In fact, I think they turned 20 years old late last year, right?
Yes, they did.
What do you remember about those early days and getting things off the ground? What was driving it? What do you remember about that time?
Yeah.
I can't imagine the groundwork around policy and finding auditors and writing those guidelines and everything
that was involved. Fun.
Yeah,
there was a lot of friction, shall we say.
Yeah.
I mean, this came out of like a presidential PDD 63 from the Clinton era, believe it or not, back in 1998. That's a long time ago. And it was basically, we're hearing some terrorist chatter. We need to make the infrastructure secure. Okay, so we didn't really know how to do that. We heard it. We said, yes, and two thumbs up. And then we're like, okay, how the heck do we do that? Because back then, it was... the situation was even worse in terms of, you know, private ownership, public ownership, who's got the rock, who's got the rules, who can regulate, who can't. There wasn't really a lot of framework for doing anything other than saying, hey, do this stuff. And everyone going, yeah, we're going to do it. And then going, how are we going to do this? How are we going to pay for this? So, you know, fast forward, terrorist attack happens 2001. Everyone says, okay, see, we told you we need to secure these things. The terrorists are serious. You know, no one really believed they were serious. Okay, now look, they're serious. They're not kidding. So let's start this discussion. At that point, we stood up with the FBI and the National Infrastructure Protection Center, which kind of spawned out of that direct decision directive. At least the electric sector and some others, banking and finance and healthcare, we kind of got together and said, okay, we'll do some things. And we kind of wrote down some stuff that we thought was good. Each sector kind of went off in their own direction and wrote down what they think was good. And we came back, and then that started kind of the regulatory path. You know, FERC tried it because they're the only agency with any authority in the electric sector, but it was still limited. It failed. It was under a market design, so that got attached to something that basically wasn't going to pass anyway. So they handed it over to NERC, and they're like, well, NERC, you're an international standards organization. At the time, NERC was not a regulator. They were really just an international standards body for engineers trying to keep the North American grid, you know, up and running. Because it was really about reliability, things like how often do you maintain your relay batteries and, you know, how far do you clear your vegetation and what kind of, you know, what frequency or hertz are you operating your system at so we can keep the grid more harmonized and efficient. And they're like, hey, NERC, you've got some international standards. Can you do this? So it kind of got passed around a little bit. And then at the 2003 blackout happened, and that was like the hammer. There was immediately after that, FERC got authority, NERC became a regulator, and then off we were to the races to implement these things we wrote a few years ago as now new standards or urgent action standards.
Right.
Then it became the hard path of, like, you know, getting out the site and picking your line and, you know, cutting the trees, pulling the stumps, paving the road. We didn't know what we were doing. And most of us at least were honest about the fact that, hey, this is new. We don't know what we're doing. We're trying to figure this out. But then, you know, over years, it's been refined. And I think it's served its usefulness. It got everybody at least aware. It got everybody aligned. We established a base, you know, minimum security controls that are required in the power sector.
Right.
At this point now, we're chasing technology shifts. We're chasing virtualization, cloud, you know, these new forms of access control that didn't exist, all the different arrays of technologies, things that were used to be the size of a refrigerator and now the size of an iPhone. So all of this change in technology since then, it's outlived its standard. It's outlived its usefulness as a standard. Yeah. And I think it's going to collapse under its own weight because of the administrative burden and the struggle necessary to try and maintain this over time. Mm-hmm. Because the industry writes it. So the NERC SIP standard is not written by, you know, an agency. They're written by the industry themselves. People dedicate their time. They donate people to go write these things. Then the industry votes on them. So they're making their own future. I get that. But honestly, you know, FERC has made multiple, you know, very clear messages around how they think that the SIP standards are insufficient and they would rather use NIST. And if we're going to go that way, let's just rip off the Band-Aid. Let's stop these gyrations in the SIP space and say, great, it got us where we wanted to be. Now it's time to kind of shift over to this measuring stick instead, and we're going to align with it. I mean, a different standard. Honestly, most of it's covered under the SIP standards. We're not talking about some radical shift of new things. It's just moving your stuff into a different bucket because you're probably already doing it. So, yeah, that's kind of the path that I think we're definitely where we started and where I hope we will ultimately end up just from an efficiency standpoint. But I see where the SIP standards are going now, and I regularly, you know, create new expletives and profanities just for the frustration. And the sad part is I'm a consultant in the space, and I can continue making plenty of money on this stuff as it, you know, fragments and gets more specialized. But it just seems like what a colossal waste of time and money when there are better options.
Right. I mean, 20 years in tech, that's 10 lifetimes of innovation and change. And it kind of makes sense that, you know, these things have a lifespan. And if the standard is kind of reaching its end, then, you know, maybe NIST or, you know, some other successors is the way to go. And maybe now is the time.
Yeah. I would hope so. And I think not just because it's the right thing for the SIP standards, but we're looking at a very unique situation where we've got a bunch of external pressures. We have a bunch of internal pressures. It's at a very interesting kind of set of different variables are all coalescing into a place where right now it makes a lot of sense to do this for all of the sectors in a common way with a common approach so that everybody knows, hey, all of us, everybody, all the vendors, all the manufacturers, all the consultants, all the infrastructures, we can all say effectively along with the federal government, that way is north. Mm-hmm. And right now we're all running off in different directions and hoping we're doing the right thing in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Yeah. Stuff's too important to kind of just let it flow wherever it goes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Patrick, I think that's a great place to leave it. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and let's definitely do it again sometime.
Yeah, sure, anytime.
All righty, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.